Catholic Answers Live. Happy Feast of Saint Hyacinth, I think, in the old calendar, something like that. Or is that a flower? Is that a plant? Or
I think it's both. Hyacinth is a flower.
Yeah. And I'm not sure.
But isn't John Hyacinth? Is that who you're thinking of?
You know what? And I went to Extraordinary Form today, Trent, because thanks be to God, because so that we can have sufficient physical distancing in our chapel during this time.
Yes.
This unprecedented time.
Right.
Our chaplain, Father Jerome Maloki, colleague of Father Hugh Barber, or confrere, I should say, is saying two masses a day. What a great gift for Catholic Answers. So we have Ordinary Form at 8:30 and Extraordinary Form at 11:30.
Ah, it's beautiful.
It is.
I mean, it's great that we're so blessed to have that. I have noticed in other places where my wife and I had the privilege to visit the Dallas-Fort Worth area a few weeks ago, and we attended the Byzantine liturgy there at St. Basil the Great, which is actually bursting at the seams with people, and they've had to do two divine liturgies just to accommodate the restrictions, but also just because of that surge of interest.
Probably, yes, exactly. They have some newcomers.
They do. And so, yeah, it was a treat and a privilege to be there. Loved everybody there. And of course, it's always nice whenever we're in Dallas, I can get myself some good barbecue.
Yeah, for sure. My parents go to the Ordinariate Parish.
Yes,
in
they have the Anglican Ordinariate. That's right.
Yeah, what we used to call Anglican use, I guess they call it Ordinariate now.
Yeah.
And that's in Arlington, St. Mary the Virgin. They've been going there for almost since the very beginning. Yeah. Though oddly enough, they weren't part of that original congregation, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, they've been there for going back to the Father Hawkins days. My name is Christopher Check. I am sitting in for Cy Kellett. The show is Catholic Answers Live. Sitting with me in studio, Trent Horn. We're talking in the second hour about the same thing we were talking about in the first hour, Secrets to Sharing the Faith, 888-318-7884. Let's go straight to Jonathan in San Francisco, watching on YouTube. Thanks for watching on YouTube, Jonathan. What's your question for Trent?
Hi, thanks. I was talking to my friends about Christian persecution in the U.S., but they dismissed it completely, saying that we actually enjoy Christian privilege. And so I've never heard of this before, so I don't even know how to address it.
The Archbishop of San Francisco would be interested to hear this right now, because he can only have, 12 people at a mass at a time or something like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, Jonathan, the term means different things, but the idea behind privilege is that if you belong to a certain kind of class, usually a race, ethnicity, or socioeconomic group, and in some cases a religion like Christianity, that you are privileged in society, and so you're able to avoid negative outcomes or even persecutions that might affect other groups. So how should we respond to claims like this? I think it's important for us to have dialogue and to just be realistic in our conclusions that we reach. It's never really the case that one side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong on this. Do Christians have some elements that are privileged in the United States? Yeah, I would say so. Because we are, most people in the United States identify as Christian. And so there is more widespread knowledge of the Christian faith, even if much of it's erroneous. Many holy days, the term holiday, it goes back to, I'd imagine, holy days, like holy days of obligation. Many federal holidays also coincide with Christian holy days. Christmas would be a prime example of that. You'll have people that might have more negative attitudes towards some religious groups as opposed to Christianity because they're more fearful. But I would say also, Jonathan, on the flip side, you might say, well, in the United States, maybe we're not persecuted in the same way as Christians in Muslim theocracies are persecuted through death or being legally prohibited from sharing their faith. But there's other kinds of things where Christians receive misplaced treatment. I could give you a few examples of that. One would be their portrayal in media. It's interesting, people, when you ask people, Chris, what percentage of the population is LGBT, you'll get numbers like 15%, 25%, large numbers, even though it's really somewhere between 1% and 3%. And why is that? Well, because when you go to television, The number of characters on television, I think it ranges somewhere from 15 to 20% identify as...
There has to be one in every show, in every sitcom.
In LGBT. Yes, that's right. Yeah. But I'll ask you this. When's the last time you saw a Christian character on television who wasn't a religious zealot?
Or a goon.
Or a goon or an antagonist. It's extremely rare. The only one that comes to my mind is on the old episodes of Law & Order SVU, you had Detective Stabler, who is a good old Catholic, you know, trying to wrap his head around things.
The Tom Selleck character, the Blue Bloods, about the cop family.
Oh, yes.
Generally portrayed favorably.
Yeah, but if you think about this, though, how many characters on television are functional atheists?
Right. Almost all.
Which is, if you define, because atheists will say, what is an atheist? An atheist is just someone who lacks belief in God. So if you have a character on television that never references God ever in the entire series, they're an atheist.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, they lack a belief in God. So I would say 90% of characters on television are atheist. And the ones that are Christian are rooted in stereotypes. Jonathan, I also give the example to say, well, what kind of privilege do Christians have when Christians who are faithful to the teachings of Christ and oppose things like abortion or especially so-called same-sex marriage? If you publicly oppose same-sex marriage here in the United States, you can lose your job. You can be fired from a company because you bring them bad press. That happened. Even if you donate to a campaign, like the founder of Mozilla Firefox a few years ago, he donated to Prop 8 here in California. He's Mormon, and he was out. So if you have these views in our cancel culture, if you espouse genuine Christian beliefs, especially on morality, you can be canceled. Whereas in our culture, if you espouse views on LGBT issues that correspond with popular narrative, you're praised as a hero. So I think there's you can say, yeah, it's a multifaceted issue. In some respects, Christianity is privileged in that it's a widely known religion and there are some benefits to being Christian. But on the other hand, you could say, look, would you agree that people can react negatively, especially to Christians who espouse the traditional Christian view of morality? So is that a helpful reply?
Yes, it is. It sort of sounds like they aren't making an argument against Christianity itself, but as a society at large, maybe?
A cultural phenomenon.
They're disputing the claim that Christians are persecuted. And what I would say is, well, Christians who are willing to defend the traditional teachings of Christianity are. If you identify as Christian in popular culture, but you also affirm the evils of the day, they see no contradiction there. That's completely fine. And I'm sure in ancient Rome, as long as even if you went to mass, if you sacrificed to the emperor, you're still in the good books with them. In many other cultures, like, well, as long as you just sacrifice to the emperor, our heathen god, we can accommodate both. Whereas Christians would say, no, we can't. I will say also, though, Jonathan, when it comes to this, you can give an example to them of, I wouldn't use the term persecution, but you could use the term prejudice, because persecution implies dragging people to the Colosseum and throwing them to the lions. But you could say, are Christians victims of prejudice? And I would say in this society, yes. Look at judicial hearings, for example. Look at nominees to the Supreme Court who are grilled by United States senators because they belong to Catholic fraternal...
to the Knights of Columbus.
Right. We have in the news today Kamala Harris. It's Kamala, right?
Kamala, I don't know Kamala.
Well, you can get in trouble if you mispronounce it the wrong way. I read more than I watch the news. But Vice President Kamala Harris grilled, I forget who it was, asking him, you know, do you think it's problematic that you're a part of the Knights of Columbus?
Well, she was, and the way that she was phrasing the questions was almost absurd. Well, it was absurd. She was saying, were you aware when you joined the Knights of Columbus that they were opposed to marriage equality?
Well, it's like, I was aware they're Catholic,
right,
and they uphold the truth about marriage. So you can point out that in popular culture, has there been an atheist, or I'll give you another example, Muslims who are running for higher office, would they receive those kinds of questions from a judicial panel, Senate Judiciary Committee?
Unlikely.
No, absolutely would not happen. Or consider this, a Christian baker who refuses to create a cake for a same-sex wedding. They're called a bigot. And yet I've seen people do videos where they call Muslim bakeries and ask for the same thing and are denied. And you don't hear anything in the wider culture about homophobic Muslim bakers. because nothing like that. It's only Christians that are singled out. So Jonathan, you can point out that Christians bear an unusual kind of prejudice in our culture, especially those who are not Christian in name only, but uphold the traditional teachings of the Christian faith.
Thanks for your call, Jonathan. 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I'm Chris Check, sitting in for Cy Kellett. My guest is Trent Horn. We're talking about how to share the Catholic faith. Call with your questions about conversations that you have had or conversations that you are anticipating, whether it be with atheists or Protestants or non-Catholics or even Catholics. Maybe there are Catholics in your own parish who have not had the benefit of all the training that you have had or education that you have had with respect to the faith, and you're trying to explain the fullness of the teaching of the church to them. Let's go to... Forgive me if I pronounce this incorrectly.
Haikil
in Costa Rica, watching on YouTube Live. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Good.
Hi.
How did I do with your name there, my friend?
Yes, correct. It is Haikil.
Haikil. Okay, yeah. Very good.
Yeah, but actually, also in Spanish, I have the same problem because the people is not very sure how to pronounce it, so it's fine.
Of course.
How can we help you?
It is about the Marian doctrines, actually, just because today I found in the YouTube channel of Alpha and Omega Ministries, James White. He recently published Are the Marian Doctrines Authentic Christian Teaching? So I saw it, I believe, and I like the explanations, but the point that he made, or one of the points that he made, it's really interesting because, for instance, if it is married, it's very important for us. Why it didn't be taught by the apostles, or why after many centuries it was developed. For instance, the final dogma of the Assumption.
Okay, so his concern is, and I haven't had the chance to review these recent podcasts that James White has done on the Marian dogmas, but...
He's your old debating friend.
Yes, we had a debate in 2017 on the question, can a Christian lose his salvation? Which actually several Protestants said they enjoyed the presentation I put forward and thought it was much more biblical than James White's presentation, actually. And who knows, maybe we'll have another debate in the future. You never know. So I haven't had a chance to review this, but I'm assuming the argument he's making is that we should not believe the Marian dogmas, especially the Immaculate Conception and the virginity of Mary, are apostolic because we don't see them formally defined until much later in church history. And we don't see evidences of them until several centuries after the time of the apostles. So one point I would make is that the formal definition of a doctrine, that does not entail that the doctrine sprang into existence ex nihilo. Many times, something can be believed throughout the church's history before it's formally defined. James White would agree that Christians held to traditional Christology in the early church, they held to traditional Christology, Christ being fully God and fully man, even though it wasn't formally defined until the later councils of Nicaea, Ephesus, and Chalcedon. And he would hold this view even if anti-Trinitarians said to James White, well, look, you look at these early church fathers. They don't talk about hypostatic union. They don't use the same language that we see of the Chalcedonian fathers. Even the doctrine that Christ had two wills, a human and a divine will, is not defined until, Third Constantinople. That's not until seven centuries later. And you don't see it in the early writings of the church fathers. And yet we have the magisterium able to guide us and show the doctrinal continuity of these teachings. So I think it's important to point out a bit of a double standard here. You'll have people like James White will hold this view, and yet other anti-Trinitarians will launch these similar attacks on things like Christology. We had very little discussion of Christ's celibacy in the early church, for example, because it simply wasn't attacked. Also, what's funny to me, Chris, is this comes back to our debate that we had about whether a Christian could lose his salvation, the doctrine of eternal security. I challenged White in the debate. I said, is there anybody who believed this doctrine before Calvin? Anybody? And he threw out an offhand.
He had one example.
Well, he talked Fulgentius, who was right. a contemporary of Augustine, but no citation to go along with
right.
it. And he can't, because even you have other Protestant scholars, John Jefferson Davis would be an example of this, did a study on eternal security, saying it was not believed until Calvin. It just wasn't. And yet he holds that as a pillar of what he believes in Reformed theology. So it's okay for what you believe to have had no trace in history until the 16th century. But for what we believe as Catholics, you have to be able to find it in the first or second centuries, or else it's a no-go. So to me, that's a bit of a double standard there. And so I would point out that many other doctrines that Christians believe in, like take the Immaculate Conception, when people say, well, why aren't there explicit references to Mary's being conceived from, protected from even original sin in the Apostolic Fathers? Why don't we have those kinds of references? Well, we don't have references to original sin before Augustine. We don't. I mean, you have Christians today who claim that original sin is an unbiblical idea. The term is not found in Scripture.
No.
They'll say that it's a misreading of Romans chapter 5. That's the Pelagian controversy. It was not until Pelagius that the church formally articulated a doctrine of original sin to combat that heresy, and which then raised the question, which prior to that, people agreed that Mary was like the Ark of the Covenant, protected from all stain. You had Ephraim the Syrian speaking of this, that she was, you see a trajectory in Marian understanding among the fathers that she was, she's the Ark, she's the new Eve, she is without stain, incorruptible, and she is without sin, and Augustine believed this. But then understanding what does that mean in light of original sin, in that she is also fully human and a part of the human race, that even Aquinas tried to wrap his head around this subject, and it wasn't fully defined until 1854. But we still see the threads of that doctrine, just as the same as we see for other things Protestants believe in Christology, original sin. So I think that that's important to be able to bring up. But I tell you what, Haikil, if you stay on the line, I'd be happy to send you a copy of my book, The Case for Catholicism, where I talk about the Marian dogmas in more detail. If you stay on the line, we'll email you. We'll get your email address. We'll copy. Let's try to get that from our call screener. And I'll send you a copy of my book, The Case for Catholicism, published with Ignatius Press, that goes into this in detail. And you know what? I'll throw in Behold Your Mother as well.
What a deal.
Why not?
You hit the jackpot. God bless you, brother. We got to take a quick break. Trent, before we do, you mentioned, actually you used that expression, ex nihilo, in answering that previous question.
That's
there.
Right.
And you have coming out right now, what we call a short course, I guess, for our School of Apologetics on the question, out of nothing.
Yes.
Right? Creation out of nothing.
Yes. So this course, I'm excited, is a defense of the doctrine of creation out of nothing, that God created the world from nothing. So it is a reply. The course includes answering arguments who say God didn't make the world. It just happens to exist, or never came from nothing. It's a reply also to other religious groups like Mormons, who would say that God created the world, but from pre-existing matter. So Mormons do not believe, well, they don't believe that God is God from all eternity. They believe God is an exalted man. And there's an infinite number of deities, only one of which you worship, and that this deity created our universe from eternally pre-existing matter. And so in my course, I defend the traditional Athanasian defense of God, that he is the cosmic creator. He's not merely a craftsman. And that's all in my new course.
To get Trent's course, Creation Out of Nothing, or any of the courses in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, visit shop.catholic.com right now. And we are running a special $10 off the regular price on Trent's course, Creation Out of Nothing, right back after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Prayer has been so powerful in my communication with God, understanding the church better, most importantly, understanding the Lord better, and myself better. I heard it said once that God answers knee-mail, as in K-N-E-E. Prayer is powerful. One of the favorite things I love to do when it comes to prayer is to ask for the intercession of the great saints. Try it sometime. You'll be very, very impressed and surprised by the amazing power of prayer.
Catholic Answers Live. Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett, who will be back in this chair and behind this microphone tomorrow. There in the control booth, Trent, operating the TriCaster, which is that very complex piece of equipment that operates the little cameras here.
Yeah, it runs our little BB-8 Panasonic cameras, like BB-8 from the new Star Wars trilogy. That's what they kind of remind me of. They got one little eye and they look around at us.
They do. And a lot of people listening might not know that you can actually watch this show.
You can.
On YouTube, on the Catholic Answers YouTube channel, on Catholic Answers Facebook, or just make it simple. Go to Catholic.com.
That's great. When you go on the website, it always reminds me, Chris, oh, the show is going on.
The show's on right now.
Because when you go to the website, the show pops right up. You can watch it live there.
Yeah, but anyway, operating the cameras is Francesca Vercillo.
Francesca Vercillo.
Or as we say here, Vercillo.
Vercillo.
I like Vercillo.
Donissimo, I do not know Italiano.
And Francesca is the eldest daughter of John Vercillo.
Bellissima.
Yeah, she is bellissima.
Bellissima.
And she is the eldest daughter of John Vercillo, our director of video. So obviously some nepotism. He got his daughter a job here.
We promote family values here as often as we promote family members.
I'm in favor of it, especially Vercillo family.
Well, that's an Italian thing right there.
Beautiful matriarch Sarah there.
Keeping the family.
But Francesca is off tomorrow to be a freshman at Thomas Aquinas College.
Oh, TAC.
Just north of us. So she'll be following in the footsteps of Emily Sanchez, my assistant there. Or who's here now, but
right.
Was
I'm
a graduate,
like, she's
right.
Going back to school?
Yeah, no, please, God.
Or maybe
not.
Maybe she will go back with Francesca and they could reboot that Rodney Dangerfield film, Back to School.
Yeah, I'm very, very happy if Emily just stays here.
But that's fine too.
We wish Francesca well. We ask all of our listeners to pray for her and all freshmen returning.
So she's actually going to a physical school.
Yeah, amazing, right?
In this state, they're letting her do that?
I don't think they know. I think Governor Newsom doesn't know.
Shh. We'll keep that between us and everyone listening.
I feel fairly confident Governor Newsom is not listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Well, it might behoove him to do that, given the weighty responsibilities he has in this state.
We'd love to have him on the show sometime. Trent Horn talks to Governor Newsom.
I would be happy to. I have dialogues with all kinds of individuals, and that would hopefully be a productive one as
you
well.
You can tell him how to share the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Marianne in California, watching on YouTube Live. Marianne, welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, Marianne, are you there?
So my question is yeah, I'm here.
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. My question is, so recently I've been like on social media a lot because of quarantine and all. Mm-hmm. And so I saw this post in particular. I'm Filipino, and so of course I have like a lot of Filipino friends. Most of them are Catholic. And I saw this post. I know this person isn't really practicing the faith, but they posted this video or reposted from somewhere else. This person saying like, we shouldn't be Christians or Catholic because of the Spaniards colonizing the Philippines way back then, because they took away our ancestors' language, their traditions. And so it's bad. Like, they infringed Christianity on them, so we lost most of our culture or where we truly came from, like our actual roots. Mm-hmm. And so that made me think, it made me think, like, I'm thankful that I'm able to, you know, practice my faith as a Catholic and being born and raised in a Catholic family.
Right.
But a part of me is like, that's part of our history, like being colonized, our ancestors being colonized, and having like Christianity founded, like being a huge part of our Philippine of the country right now.
Right.
And so my question is, like, how can I respond to this? Like, is it God's plan or is it mostly like humans doing it? Like, I'm not really sure how to respond to it.
Sure.
Because I even asked my boyfriend about it. He's like, yeah, I'm split 50 and 50. Because, like, first, I'm thankful that I am Catholic. And on the part of me is like, but our ancestors weren't.
Marianne, that's a very thoughtful question. And I'm just going to let you know, we're going to get Trent to start to answer it, but we're going to come against the hard break. And yeah. So we'll pick up a more thorough answer on the other side of the break.
Yeah. What I would say just to start would be to ask the question, does it follow? Even if it were evil for the Spaniards to colonize the Philippines, what follows from that about the truth of our faith? We'll answer that question when we come back.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. The show is Catholic Answers Live. My guest is Trent Horn. We're talking about how to share the Catholic faith right back after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
This is Dr. David Anders. Does the problem of evil keep you from believing in God?
Join us for Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Before the break, Trent, we were talking to Marianne here in California, who is of Filipino descent, or she's Filipino, and some of her Filipino friends are saying that she should not practice the Catholic faith because it was brought by Spain that colonized the right. Philippines and changed or even destroyed the native culture.
Right. So Marianne, there's a few points that I would raise in this regard. So I think you need to ask the big questions here. All right, suppose, just hypothetically, it were wrong for the Spanish government, the Kingdom of Spain, to colonize the Philippines several centuries ago and uproot different native traditions and commit offenses against indigenous peoples. And the church was instituted in the Philippines during this time. In fact, I was just looking up, there's actually two saints who are recognized from the Philippines. They are previous bishops and I think archbishops of Cebu, the area of Philippines. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Would that show God doesn't exist? No. Would that show that Jesus did not rise from the dead? No. Would that show that Christ never built the church upon Peter and the apostles and their successors? No. So that fact would not disprove the divine foundation of the Catholic faith. All it would prove was that the church was a party to historical bad actors in history, and the church is full of fallible human beings. At worst, It would just prove that. And John Paul II has repented of things. The church, you know, there have been Catholics and members of the faithful who have done bad things throughout history. You know, we're sinful, fallible people. The sacking of Constantinople in the Fourth Crusade would be an unambiguous example that we would, at least in the Western Church, would agree is a sin of Christians committed. So I think that, Marian, in the worst case scenario, you could say all that proves is that some Catholics were party to bad things in history, not that the Catholic faith is false. And if you believe in judgment and sin and evil and redemption and all these important things to combat evils, well, then you shouldn't give up the Catholic faith. Second, though, I would say that one should challenge this narrative that, oh, well, they colonized this area and that's always a bad thing. I mean, it's bad to stamp out indigenous traditions that are morally neutral or morally good. But in many cases, Marianne, these people they're upset that morally bad traditions were stamped out. I mean, in other parts of history where the church has colonized areas, where people have engaged in colonization, bad traditions were stamped out. In India, for example, people practiced sati. They did that up to the end of the 20th century, which is the tradition of burning a widow on her husband's funeral pyre alive. Christians in colonized areas have opposed things like female genital mutilation, the killing of twins in the Amazon region because there's a belief that they're possessed. So I think it's good that some traditions are stamped out. And one tradition being a failure to recognize the true God and his son Jesus Christ, we should bring all people to that. To say that some indigenous people should not be, the gospel should not be presented to some indigenous people, but it should be presented to others like atheists in North America. To say it's okay to evangelize white atheists in North America, but not people of color in other parts of the world is a racism, Chris.
Yeah.
Because it's saying that white atheists in America can handle receiving the gospel and challenging it and engaging in dialogue, but people of color and indigenous groups are somehow too weak to be able to do that as well.
Do you know something, Trent? President McKinley, one of the reasons he invaded the Philippines during the Spanish-American War,
right,
was to free the Filipinos from the superstitions of Catholicism.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's a reverse. You have Protestants that will go and have been doing that for a long time. So, Marianne, I think you should also point out it's interesting. This is a minor point, but I think it's one that's worth bringing up. A lot of people think, Chris, they buy into this stereotype that indigenous peoples are all peaceful and live in harmony with one another in nature.
Like the Aztecs.
Yes. See Apocalypto if you want to see the irony of Chris's comment. Whereas colonizers and people in the West are always evil and bring about the ruin of civilizations. And yet what was common in these cultures was for indigenous peoples to invade, acquire land and spouses and women from other cultures. You can go online and read entire articles about warfare in the pre-colonized Philippines. There was a large battle that took place in 1365 between the Northern Kingdom of the Philippines and the Southern Kingdom. And when people won in these battles, they brought their own particular traditions and cultures present. So it's possible that many of the traditions your Filipino friends may be talking about that they favor were actually brought about by other Filipino colonizers 1,000 years ago that defeated one tribe and brought their own local traditions and supplanted that tribe. So it's interesting, if they're going to reject Catholicism for that reason, they very well may have to reject their own traditions.
Sure.
That were brought about through intra-indigenous colonization, if you will. But I think that the big point, though, to get back is it good for people to know the true God and the salvation he's given us in Christ? Why would we deny that to anyone because of their race? That's ultimately the cornerstone, Marianne, that we have to go back to when sharing this with individuals. So is that a helpful start, at least?
Yes, that's really helpful. Like, that really opened my eyes because, like, you kind of forget, like, the mission. Like, we need to recognize that.
There you go.
God, mm-hmm. We need to recognize God and Jesus. Yeah.
Bigger really than any man. Now, it's fine to have our traditions. And if you look at the Catholic Church of the Philippines, the Catholic Church in Africa, there are many liturgies and celebrations that include these local and indigenous ways of living out the faith. As long as they are not antithetical to the gospel, the Catholic Church, you almost can say the Catholic churches, given the number of independent sui juris autonomous churches, you know, the Chaldean, Byzantine, etc., living out the one faith with local customs but always with customs that are not antithetical to the gospel.
You know, Marianne, to Trent's point there, I want to tell you, on the Esquiline Hill, there are seven hills in Rome, and one of them is called the Esquiline. At the top of the Esquiline Hill is one of the great Marian shrines, Mary Major, St. Mary Major, or Maria Maggiore, as the Italians call it. But as you're walking up the Esquiline Hill, there is a church there called Santa Pudenziana, and it's one of the oldest churches in the city of Rome. It has one of the most beautiful apse mosaics, fourth, early fifth century, maybe, beautiful apse mosaic. And it is built over where tradition has it that St. Peter would, over a home, a senator's home, where St. Peter might have said Mass or would have said Mass when he was in Rome. Today, Santa Pudenziana is the Philippine church in Rome. Mm. And if you want to have a sense of the Church Universal, go in there when Mass is underway and the folk guitars are playing and the songs are being, I'm going to get it. Is it Tagalog or Tagalog? I never know how to say it.
I want to say Tagalog.
Yeah, forgive me. But anyway.
Mary, you can correct us if we're wrong. That, I believe it's Tagalog.
But you go in there and in this ancient, ancient Paleo-Christian church with this beautiful apse mosaic, you have this lively liturgy going on, such as you described, Trent, and it is so obvious that the church is universal. It's just made so obvious there.
Yes.
God bless you, Marianne. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Barbara in Fayetteville, North Carolina, listening on EWTN Radio. Barbara, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you for taking my call.
For sure.
So I've got a 14-year-old who's just starting high school this year, and since all of the recent upheavals and social unrest and everything, she has started educating herself on social justice, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And
sure.
She's now currently fashioning herself as a socialist or a Marxist.
Mm. Okay.
And I'm an active member of our Legion of Mary in our parish's Presidium. So when she asks me what I think about it, the only thing I could tell her was, yeah, I've been all through all of that myself. You know, I went to a liberal arts college. I studied philosophy. So no more need be said about that. I said, but I came out the other end, and I found that, you know, her faith is what is really true. She wants something more concrete. You know,
of course.
And I was just hoping you might be able to help me offer her something more concrete from a Catholic perspective.
We should say at the outset, Trent, that it is possible to attend a liberal arts college and study philosophy and actually have that be a good thing.
Yes, it is. I studied philosophy in my undergrad at a secular liberal arts college, though one should be firmly grounded in the faith before engaging
you,
such a favor. But yes, it's. I think, Barbara, I mean, this is something not uncommon for teenagers. That's why I wrote my book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Because members of generation millennials and now Gen Z are in favor of socialism, mostly because they don't know what it is. So you should just ask her, well, what do you think socialism is? If you think it's the view that government should make sure that people are provided for, that nobody dies of hunger or freezes to death, then that's not socialism. That's social welfare. And every state or most states have a program like that where government uses public funds to provide for the less fortunate. That's not socialism. Socialism is the view that productive property, the things that make wealth, goods and services, this should be owned by everybody. And if it's owned by everyone, then the fruits of that should be given equally to everyone. So you had even the Fabian socialists, Marxists believed this, but the Fabian socialists believed this too, that income should be divided equally. You know, you don't want to have people who are rich, no rich, no poor, that we're treated equally. But the problem is we're not all equal. And you could give a thought experiment to your 14-year-old daughter, Barbara, on this. You could ask her, imagine you went to class, like, you know, take a paper that she's worked on and worked really hard on. And she got like a really good grade on it. And she said, how would you feel if you turned in that paper you normally would have gotten a 98 on? And your teacher said, I tell you what, kids, some of you are unequal. Some of you have more help than others. You know, you're unequal, so it's not fair. So all of your grades, I've averaged them together, and so everybody gets an 85 on the tests. So Would you want to be in a class like that? Ask her, would you really want a class like that where all the grades are averaged together, everybody gets the same grade, no matter how much work they do or not? And I'm sure your daughter would, hopefully, she may give you some pushback, but she really thought about that. No, she wouldn't want, if she cares about schooling and working hard, she wouldn't. Even if she doesn't, she could see that kind of system wouldn't work because once enough people stop trying, all the grades will plummet. And the analogy here is when you apply that to economics and work and production and capital and income, economies fail, and they always do in
well,
that regard.
Or Trent, how about medical school? I prefer to have my heart operated on by the guy that did really well in medical school.
Yeah, not someone who just got a grade because he got the good average from everybody else working hard.
Right.
So we have to understand people are equal in dignity. We ought to engage in social welfare to care for the less poor, and government has a role in that. But socialism is a bridge too far. So Barbara, we will send you a copy. Give us your email address. We will send you a copy of my new book. Let's do two copies. One for Barbara, one for her daughter. Two copies of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? And then I think that she'll find that to be hopefully an open mind to be able to read through that. You could also purchase it for her on Audible if she enjoys audiobooks. I've read the book online, but we'll get you two hard copies of that.
Another book, Barbara, that you're going to want to look into, and it might be more lifting than your 14-year-old is willing to do, but the compendium of social teaching of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, especially in the modern era, has been a great champion of social justice, especially beginning with Leo XIII with his encyclical Rerum Novarum. And so that's a place to start as well. Get a copy of that compendium of social teaching of the Catholic Church. And then that'll start to give you the ideas for good conversations with your daughter. Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, sounds great. Thank you very much.
Okay, leave us your email. God bless you, dear.
Sounds good.
Let's go to just a second. Trent.
Yes.
This is amazing. We are selling our 20 answers booklets for $1 each. Some of these you have written.
I have.
The Eucharist, Faith and Science, Death and Judgment. That comes for all of us, that one.
Can't escape it. Just like taxes here in California.
Right. God, the real Jesus, the Church. Oh, we were talking about this in the last hour. Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, the Bible, and abortion. Those are the ones that Trent has penned. There are many more in the series. I think there's more than 30 in the 20 answer series, and they typically cost more than $1 each, but we are selling them for $1 between now and Saturday. So visit shop.catholic.com, where all of the 20 answers books and ebooks are $1 each. That's a savings of 75%. Act now. It's a flash sale, which means Saturday it's gone. Shop.catholic.com.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
A very wonderful woman I knew had 4 children, and all 4 died. And somebody went up to her one day, and they said, oh, what a pity. And she said, oh, no, what a blessing. If we don't begin to look at everything with the eyes of Jesus, you will become helpless and hopeless.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Catholic Answers Live. Holly, Peter, Calvin, let's see if we can do this. Holly in Birmingham, Alabama, welcome to the program. What's your question for Trent?
Thank you. My question is, I have a Protestant friend, and they say that you there can't be such a thing as praying to saints because God would not allow it. Because if they knew what was happening on earth, then they would be sorrowful. So the whole idea is problematic. So
I have never heard that one, Trent.
Yes, I have heard something a little bit similar to this. This about that. Well, there can't be sadness in heaven, and so if if people who are in heaven find this out, they're going to be quite upset about this. So the argument seems to be they can't intercede for us because they don't know what's happening.
Right.
And the reason they don't know what is happening,
because if they did, they would be unhappy.
And they can't have unhappiness in heaven. Therefore, God has made them ignorant of this.
Well, QED.
So here's what I would take, Holly. This line of argument, sometimes what we can do in these kinds of discussions is to show how this line of argument that is meant to undermine Catholicism actually undermines many Protestant beliefs or Christian beliefs. Because I could run I could run a similar argument saying that I'd run the argument this way. I'd ask them, what happens to saints who are in heaven whose loved ones are in hell? So think about that. If you have a saint in heaven, I'm going to ask them, what happens if their loved one is in hell? Is God going to keep them ignorant of that fact for all eternity? I'm sure if you have all eternity, you'll have enough time to walk around heaven and see if they're there. There's only going to be a finite number of people in heaven, and you'll have an infinite amount of time in heaven. So you could find out on your own, I would imagine.
That's right. You're persistent.
I would wonder. But I think it seems to be that we would be aware of that. Now, I think your Protestant friends would say that that God could allow the saints in heaven to be aware that people, their loved ones, have been damned, but that they will not be sorrowful of this fact because they will fully understand God's justice in that He was just in condemning these people, or allowing them to condemn themselves, really. And that they will see the reality as God sees it, and because they're fully united to God, they will not be sad, but they will have, and Aquinas said that they'll actually be happy, grateful, a better way to say it, that God was merciful and gracious to them in seeing other faiths that they could have had. So I guess I might run that kind of parallel argument to say, well, by that logic then, God must keep the saints in heaven ignorant of those who are in hell. Maybe they'd accept that view, maybe they wouldn't. But there's no evidence of that in the book of Revelation, because in Revelation chapter 6, it talks about the souls who are in heaven who cry out to God, when will you provide justice for those who are suffering on the earth? That people in heaven are aware of things, including bad things that are happening. So I would also add to this argument, so I would point out that I think it doesn't make sense, like using the hell example, that if God can keep saints in heaven happy even though their loved ones are in hell, then a fortiori, then the weaker principle, He could keep saints in heaven happy who are interceding for our temporary finite problems here on earth. But then I would add positive evidence saying that, well, the saints in heaven are aware. A Bible passage that I like for that is Hebrews 12:1, which says that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And in Hebrews 11 talks about the heroes of the faith prior to Jesus. And then it goes on to say we are surrounded by these witnesses who cheer us on as we're running the race, so to speak. I have more of that. We can check that out at catholic.com. But that's probably the arguments I would go. There's positive evidence the saints are aware of what's happening on earth in Revelation and in Hebrews 12:1. And then second, if God can keep the saints happy, even if their loved ones are in hell, He can keep the saints happy even as they intercede for their loved ones on earth. So is that a helpful reply?
That's great. That is perfect.
Holly, give your email to the call screener, and we'll send you a copy of our 20 Answers booklet on prayer, written by Father Hugh Barber. It's excellent.
Yes.
Peter in Plano, Texas, north of Dallas, listening on Guadalupe Radio, our friends at Guadalupe Radio, the largest of the affiliate networks. Peter, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you very much. I have a question. We have three friends that are taking this Bible timeline.
Sure.
And we enjoy it. Two of us already gone through it before. We take everything in faith.
Sure.
This third person has a very difficult time understanding some of the Old Testament in itself, in totality, in that.
I'm sorry to rush you, Peter, but we're going to hit the clock. So if you get your question to Trent, we can get an answer to it.
Okay. Mm. All right. He says, the Old Testament, why is the Old Testament in the Old Testament where Moses and Abraham and David and Solomon
sure.
Have many wives and God does not condemn them?
Well, actually, he does. He does condemn polygamy. God does allow, in the Old Testament, we see similar to divorce, that God, he allows evils to exist for a time because of the hardness of the people's hearts, that he could pass a law, a decree saying to not abide by this, and the people could just refuse to listen. We could pass a law outlawing abortion today in the U.S. I think it would get overturned because people's hearts are still hardened to that. That's what happened for divorce, and you see that for polygamy because the Bible does speak against it. In Deuteronomy, Leviticus 18:18 says that a man cannot marry his sister-in-law while his wife is still alive. I think even if they were divorced, he could not do that. So he certainly couldn't be married to them at the same time. And yet we see Lamech, David, other people who are polygamists in Scripture. What should we make of that? Well, as I said about the condemnation, Deuteronomy 17:17 says that a ruler should not multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away from God, which is what happened with Solomon yes. and David. So actually the existence of them, their sin of polygamy, is evidence of God's moral teaching, Peter, of what you ought not do. So when we see in Scripture discussions about how husbands should treat their other wives, these are not prescriptions. They're kind of descriptive laws. So like there's laws in the Old Testament that says if one man hits another man in the head with a rock, this is what you should do. It doesn't mean God is in favor of rock slugging. It just means these things happen. Here's what you should do if it happens. If a man has more than one wife and he treats one unfairly, this is what you ought to do. But the Bible is very clear. The examples it gives of polygamy all throughout the Old Testament is it going poorly for God's people. It's something that's tolerated until we see in Matthew 19, when the Pharisees ask Jesus about divorce, Jesus lays down the law. He goes back to Genesis 2. He says he reaffirms the monogamy and lifelong exclusivity of marriage. So Jesus' affirmation saying that now the time has come under the new covenant, that your hardness of hearts are no longer an impediment under the law of grace. We have restored God's original intent for marriage in Genesis chapter 2, which overturns these transitory evils that were permitted, namely divorce and polygamy. Would you think about it? Divorce and remarriage is just a kind of serial polygamy.
Sure.
Instead of having all your wives at once, you just have them at different times. Both of these things are things that God detests and gives us the spiritual grace to overcome.
Do you take this up in Hard Sayings at all, Trent?
I do, yes. I take it up in my book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Bible Difficulties. And so I do cover it there. The Catechism also mentions polygamy as being a sin against the virtue of marriage. Though I do believe the Catholic moral tradition does deal with the thorny question. Let's say you bring the gospel to an indigenous area where people convert. What do you do when a polygamist converts and he has his four wives? Does he divorce the other three?
Right.
A general consensus is that out of the virtue of justice, he needs to maintain a standard of living and provide financially and materially for all of his wives in virtue of the vows he took with them. Even if they weren't valid marriages, he's made these women dependent upon him. So the virtue of justice demands that he provide for them materially, but the virtue of chastity would say he may only have sexual relations with the woman that is his valid wife, usually his first one.
Peter, is this helpful?
Very much. I'm just going to have to convey this to your podcast and see if you can understand that why God not condemns.
Okay. Yeah.
I could do that on a podcast episode. That'd be a good one. Maybe we'll do a full episode on that and other sins against marriage on the Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L. Check it out on iTunes and Google Play.
Calvin in Arizona, I'm sorry we did not get to you. However, I encourage you to call back when we're doing an open forum. But also, if you leave your email with the call screener,
yes.
we'll send you some information
yeah.
about your question. Trent, 2 hours flew by
they
with
did.
You. I always learn a great deal. It's a lot of fun to be with you in the studio.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Nice to have you here as well.
Educational and engaging.
Edifying indeed.
Right. Very good. And we'll see you on our high donor webinar coming up on Thursday.
Faith in the voting booth.
Faith in the voting booth. Send an email to radio@catholic.com for information. Cy Kelly will be back tomorrow. Catholic Answers Live.